Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA's Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Alternative Therapies as Treatment for Rare Neuroimmune Disorders. My name is Sam Hughes from UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, and I'll be moderating this podcast today. The TMA is a nonprofit organization focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about the TMA on their website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA's website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Ben Greenberg and Dr. Ben Thrower. Dr. Ben Greenberg is the director of the CONQUER program at UT Southwestern Medical Center and Children's Health in Dallas, Texas, where he leads clinical and research efforts for neuroimmune disorders. His research interests are in both the diagnosis and treatment of neuroimmunologic and neuroinfectious disorders. He also leads trials that study new treatments to prevent neurologic damage and restore function to those who have already been affected. Dr. Ben Thrower is the medical director of the MS Institute at Shepherd Center. Dr. Thrower is a clinical instructor of neurology at Emory University and participates actively in clinical research. He serves on the board of directors of the Georgia chapter of the National MS Society and has served on the board for the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers. Thanks, both of you, Dr. Greenberg and Dr. Thrower, for your time and your expertise sharing with us today through the next hour. And I just want to throw it over to you guys first and just kind of give some opening thoughts about what you think is the role of alternative therapies along with the traditional pharmaceuticals that we think about with rare neuroimmune disorders, just in a few sentences. Dr. Greenberg, would you like to start with your initial thoughts?
Sure. Thanks, Sam. Also want to thank the Transverse Myelitis Association for hosting the podcast series, and this one in particular, and my good colleague, Dr. Thrower. I'm looking forward to sharing this time with him and hearing his thoughts. At a high level, just a couple notes from the beginning. The first is a recognition that people use the term alternative therapies in a lot of different ways. And so as we're going through specifics, it's important to note that one person's alternative therapy may be another person's physical therapy or diet, or the fact that there are some FDA-approved agents that started off in the world of alternative therapies. And so it's a very broad term that we use. But in general, in our clinic, we separate alternative therapies into three categories. Ones that are non-FDA-approved approaches to the treatment of a condition or symptoms of a condition for which there is good data to support it. The second category is treatments of conditions for which they are considered safe, but there really is no data to support their use, or agents or approaches to therapy for which there are no data and there are potential concerns about their use or safety. And in my experience in the world of alternative therapies, the overwhelming number are category two, where we have a general sense of safety, but little to no data to support their use. We have experiential data, meaning an individual patient's experience, good or bad, relative to a therapy, but no confirmed benefit at a population level. And so as we talk about the therapies, to the best of my knowledge, I'll suggest which of these three categories any given intervention falls into.
Thanks, Dr. Greenberg. That's very clear, clear explanation of that. Dr. Thrower, would you have anything to add from a high level about alternative therapies?
Sure. And again, like Dr. Greenberg said, thank you guys so much for doing these podcasts. I think it's a great service for people with transverse myelitis. And so when we think about alternative therapies, like Dr. Greenberg says, how you define that is going to vary from one person to the next. But I also like to encourage people to think about the term complementary as an alternative to alternative, just because sometimes when people think of alternative therapies, that means in place of. So instead of partnering with your comprehensive care team, someone thinks of alternative therapy as going off the grid and doing things separate from that team. Whereas complementary might mean, yes, I'm still going to take the tools in the toolbox that my traditional team has to offer, whether it's physical therapy or medications, and I'm going to talk with that team about adding some things that might be less traditional. When we think too about why are there alternative or complementary therapies? Usually those things exist because some need is not being met. And in the case of many neurological conditions like transverse myelitis, if we had all of the answers in traditional Western medicine, I don't think the terms alternative and complementary would be used. But obviously, while we've made great strides, we don't have all the answers yet. And so I think that sometimes there is an unmet need that drives patients and families towards alternative or complementary therapies.
Thank you, Dr. Thrower, for that. I think that's a nice explanation that I don't think a lot of people necessarily think about in terms of, you know, many people think one or the other and not things altogether. So that's very helpful. So I have to apologize in advance to everybody who asked questions. There are a lot of questions that came in on this topic, and we only have the better part of an hour to get through them all. So I'm going to do my best to get to kind of the spirit of the questions and have good conversations there. And what I found looking at the questions that came in is they tended to be categorized, some questions about alternative or complementary therapies that are disease modifying, meaning that could affect the neuromyelitis optica or TM disease process, and those that are more for the purpose of symptom management, like managing pain or cognition, that kind of thing. So I want to start out with some questions regarding the disease modifying aspects of certain alternative or complementary therapies. So first of all, I'll start with Dr. Greenberg, there are some questions that came in about functional electrical stimulation and some information that's been out there that people have heard from the TM symposiums that have happened. Could you speak a little bit to the role of functional electrical stimulation, how it works or is thought to work, and what role it could play?
Yeah, Sam, it's a great question. So first, starting with electrical stimulation, the notion of electrical stimulation is you can apply electrodes to a muscle in the body, and by providing a current, an electrical current to the muscle, you can get the muscle to contract as long as there is a healthy nerve innervating the muscle. And so for people who have certain injuries where the signals can't get from their brain through their spinal cord all the way out to the muscle, electrical stimulation is a way to help keep the muscle moving while waiting for repair to occur. And so it can be used to try and help bring back the bulk of a muscle or prevent atrophy of a muscle. Functional electrical stimulation takes that concept one step further. And instead of just sitting in a chair or on a bed, stimulating a muscle to contract, relax, back and forth, functional electrical stimulation uses computers and sensors to get a muscle to contract during movement at the exact time that you would want that muscle to contract. So for example, you can put a functional electrical stimulator over the muscle that gets your ankle to bend when walking, when gets your toes to go up. So if you have a foot drop, at the exact moment when it should happen, a functional electrical stimulator can get your ankle muscles to contract so that you don't have a foot drop. And you can do this with almost not any muscle in the body. And there is experience and some data to suggest that functional electrical stimulation goes a step beyond plain electrical stimulation, because not only does it help maintain muscle health and prevent atrophy, but there is some data to suggest that it helps with plasticity and recovery and repair of the nervous system over time and improves function over time. So there are multiple devices out there. There's a functional electrical stimulation bike. There's a functional electrical stimulation stepper. There's a functional electrical stimulation hand bike, all of which can be used to try and not only maintain muscle health, but try to improve the actual neurologic function over time. Controlled studies are lacking. The safety is well established. You do need a guide, a Sherpa, a therapist who's trained in this to help get it set up. But then these are things, if you have the equipment, that people can do at home. The equipment is expensive, but if you can get it at home, it's a great addition to any rehab program.
That's a very nice explanation. And there are some other questions that came in, kind of not directly related to that modality, but about physical therapies or interventions that could lead to what you were describing about increasing function of neural pathways. And some questions regarding that and kind of the time frame. Some people have had their attack, their TM for many years. And is there a concern about, even if you were to do something like functional electrical stimulation far out from the attack, is that helpful? Is there hope in that way? Do we know anything that could help better guide that kind of treatment in terms of time frame?
So we're a big believer in the earlier the better for pretty much anything we do, but we're also a believer in the fact that there probably isn't an end date for recovery or potential for recovery. So even if I have patients who are 10 years out from their event, we will recommend functional electrical stimulation as part of their ongoing rehabilitation program. After a spinal cord event, rehabilitation is a lifelong process. It's not a do it for 6 months or a year and be done. And as long as things are done under the guidance of appropriate professionals and the techniques are safe, we really have to look at this as a long-term commitment, not just in the recovery, but once you do recover, the maintenance of that function after an event. And so we don't have an endpoint, a hard and fast endpoint for somebody for which we would say, well, too much time has passed, it's not worth it. If we can get a muscle contraction, we do it.
Dr. Thor, do you have anything to add?
I agree 100% that I think one of the weaknesses that we've had in the neurological community is that we don't emphasize enough the need for ongoing lifetime wellness and rehabilitation, whatever that looks like for the individual. What we've found in so many of our individuals with TM or NMO is that they do well when they're working one-on-one with the physical therapist, they're given or the occupational therapist, and they're given some exercises to do when they go home. And it's human nature. None of us is probably exercising as much as we should be. And so individuals go home and they drop off the radar in terms of sticking to that program. Everyone with a neurological event deserves access to this long-term wellness and rehabilitation. What we tell individuals is that if you've had transverse myelitis, if you have NMO, that you have sort of a quote-unquote bucket of disability, and some of that bucket is hardwired damage in the brain or spinal cord. Some of it is deconditioning, and everyone can do better with an aggressive rehabilitation program. The question is how much better and how do we maintain it? When we think about functional electrical stimulation and some of these other modalities, I'm not sure we know how they make people better. Is it through just simple reconditioning, working on spasticity, strengthening muscles, you know, without really affecting what's going on in the central nervous system? Or are we forming new pathways? Are we forming new connections? One of the other questions with regular exercise in the setting of an autoimmune disease is, could we actually be changing the person's immune status? Are we promoting anti-inflammatory mechanisms? I don't think we have the answers to any of these things. We know it's good, but I'm not sure we know why it's good yet.
That's interesting that you went into the conditioning conversation. There are definitely a couple questions that came in that, while didn't ask that directly, really got to that. The heart of the question was, I'm sitting, and I'm getting weaker and weaker, and really the issue there, I would say, just from looking at it, is an issue of deconditioning and kind of getting around, your head wrapped around you know, just because you can't walk doesn't mean you can't be mobile. And thinking about this idea of mobility is more than just than being able to walk around the room. And then if you have that mindset, being able to go and do things that can help with conditioning, even if it's small things that you can do. Could you speak a little bit to that, Dr. Thrower? Or do you have anything to add?
Yeah. So the last numbers I saw said that only about 15 to 20% of the U.S. population, regardless of your health state, is getting the amount of exercise that we should be getting. And now if you throw a neurological condition into that mix with maybe, you know, struggles with transportation and access to an integrated wellness program, that number's got to be dropping off really significantly. So it's about the physical part of trying to recondition people. But what we've found with our wellness program is it's also just the social aspect of getting people out of their house and having them really, in effect, being their own support group, if you will. You know, they come to a wellness program, they can hang out, you know, for hours there, they eat lunch together in the cafeteria. I think in the move to focus just on the neuroimmunology of different conditions and focus on drug management, which is we've come a long ways. We don't want to miss the symptom management, the rehabilitation, that reconditioning piece, and all of the good social aspects that go along with that.
Yeah, I think it's important to note. So moving on into kind of a different realm. There's definitely a question that came in that's a big topic in the not just neuroimmunology world, but autoimmune disease world, is the microbiome and fecal transplants. I'm going to give this one to you, Dr. Greenberg. Would you like to talk about fecal transplants?
Well, I always like to talk about fecal transplants, Sam. So for some people on the call, if this is the first time you're hearing of a fecal transplant, you may say, what the heck are these people discussing? And let me just give a little bit of background. So one of the largest and most exciting areas of research in human health and disease over the last 5 to 10 years has been in something called the microbiome. So the microbiome refers to the thousands of bacterial species that live in our colons, and we have a symbiotic relationship with them. And these different bacterial species produce proteins that the human body absorbs. And everybody has a slightly different microbiome. So I may have more of one type of bacteria than another. Sam has a different flora. Ben has a different flora. And we all live with these bacteria and absorb their proteins. And those proteins have an impact on both our health, as well as our potential to develop diseases, as well as our potential to recover from certain conditions. And so it has been shown in a growing number of articles and peer-reviewed research that there are certain microbiomes, certain bacterial species that seem to associate with different conditions. This is everything from autoimmune diseases to cancers to heart disease. And it's an area of research that is just exploding. In some conditions where there have been autoimmune diseases associated or inflammatory diseases associated with the gut, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, a variety of conditions where the immune system focus of attack is within the colon or small intestine, as well as some other conditions, the use of fecal transplants has been looked at, where you kill off somebody's microbiome and then give them a new one. And there is ample data to suggest that this is helpful for a lot of folks. In the world of autoimmune diseases of the central nervous system, transverse myelitis, neuromyelitis optica, multiple sclerosis, there are projects either underway or some that have been published that have found some associations between certain bacteria in the gut and development or propagation of some of these conditions. The challenge for the next 5 to 10 years is to sort through these big data sets, because we don't yet know which are the bacteria that are giving one person problems versus a different bacteria in another person. And secondly, we are still working on how do you adjust somebody's microbiome? So just because I prove that bacteria X is causing me problems, how do I control it or kill it off? In the world of alternative therapies, there has been an explosion in the use of probiotics to maintain gut health. And at least in my practice, I put probiotics into the category of having an excellent safety record and a probable but unproven benefit for our patients. What I don't know is which probiotic to take. I'm interested to hear if Dr. Thrower has a go-to probiotic. I don't. I tell people to try one and stay on it for a couple months and see if they perceive a benefit or not. You'll read a lot of internet posts that claim one probiotic is definitely better than another, soil-based organisms versus not. And the answer is nobody knows which is the best probiotic. But doing trials of probiotics to see how you feel is a safe way to go. And in the future, I think we will see a much more targeted approach to managing the microbiome. But Ben, is this something that comes up in your practice?
Every day, and I'm with you. I believe that it's probably a good thing. I don't have hard data yet to say that it is. I think that certainly the risk is minimal. I'm like you. I don't know which one to recommend. And the challenge is people can spend an awful lot of money on some of these things. On one hand, I'm tempted just to have people do Culturel over the counter. It's been around forever. It's inexpensive. But I will have individuals say, well, no, that's really not adequate, and you need to do, you know, probiotic X, Y, or Z. And I'm not there yet that I can make a specific recommendation. I would say, so, you know, with the fecal transplants, Emory University does have a program so far where we've used it just in individuals who have killed their normal, you know, flora with antibiotics, and you're reestablishing that. I was unaware until I really started looking at that there were actually poop banks. So those that there are repositories where there are individuals who collect this, you know, store fecal matter. I always challenged my 20-year-old son and said, if you think your job is rough or that school's rough, just think you could work in the poop bank.
Yeah. Yeah, something to think about when you're having a bad day at work.
Yeah.
I think that's always very helpful information with this kind of new research that's going on. And I mean, a lot of questions that come up with different patients, as this kind of alludes to when you're talking about probiotics, is diet in general. And when you're talking about the microbiome and what to eat, what not to eat, and all of these different diets, and there's so much information out there that is so anecdotal. And this other podcast have been about diet in particular and nutrition. But is there any just a word or two that you have to say about how the thoughts about diet as alternative therapies in terms of microbiome and all of that?
I don't think any diet has been proven yet in, you know, most of our autoimmune conditions. And from a practical standpoint, I encourage people to step back and say, you know, look at your health as not just, you know, your neurological condition, but your overall health. People, you know, tend to die of heart disease, cancer, and stroke. So do things that are going to minimize your risk for that. I'm always a little worried about some of the faddish diets that come out because a lot of times they're unproven, and a lot of times they're unsustainable. People just can't stick to them. So I tend to steer people towards something that looks more like a Mediterranean diet, where you can still have some fun, you can have some red wine, and you're not having to buy anything special, and your health is never going to suffer for being on that sort of diet.
Mm. Dr. Greenberg, do you have anything to add? Any words?
Yeah, I agree with Ben. I'm actually a believer that diet makes a huge difference in not just health, but our patients' lives who have been diagnosed with one of these rare conditions. I just don't know which one to recommend. And so in general, when thinking about diet, I think about it just like the drugs we prescribe. There are going to be responders and non-responders to any intervention, including diet. And there are going to be unique risks to some people that don't exist for others for an intervention. And so when pursuing diet, which I highly recommend people take a very close look at what they are eating and try and eat as healthy a diet as possible, that if they're going to make major dietary changes, that they need to do it and stick to it for 6 to 8 weeks to really gauge, is it going to have a symptomatic benefit to people? If people can find a dietary way to manage pain or spasticity, and it means less prescriptions, I am all for it. And so as long as I'm in the loop and I know what people are trying and people understand that it may not be the food, it may be the way the food affects the microbiome, that they need to give it time to see if it's going to work or not, and they can't cheat, then I'm all for people exploring diet.
Yeah, I think that's you get to an important point there. As when we're talking about either, whether it be a probiotic or diet change, understanding that when it comes to the microbiome, it's not an overnight fix, and it's very particular in how that works and how change occurs. And being having a patience and a kind of discipline to go through that. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, Dr. Greenberg?
Well, you know, it is an issue of a lot of people will come in and say, the most common question that comes up in my clinic is, I've heard gluten is responsible for everything evil in the world. I've been told to go gluten-free. What do you think? And what I remind people is that it's probably the best example of gluten allergies are actually pretty rare. But a lot of people come back to clinic and say they felt better by going gluten-free. And in general, what my best guess is what's happening is people who go gluten-free by definition are going relatively low carb. And I think we're changing our microbiomes by changing our diets in those ways. And some people just feel better with a different bacterial species. But if you ask anybody who has done a South Beach or an Atkins diet or a gluten-free diet, and they've been really good about it for 2 or 3 or 4 months, what happens to them if they cheat, if they have that one donut one day that they, or the one piece of pizza that they haven't had, they will tell you 2 to 3 hours later, they don't feel well. Things have changed. And what we have to remember is when we're doing dietary changes, if the benefit of the dietary change is via changing our microbiome, a little bit of cheating leads to a lot of bacterial growth. And so if we're really going to be serious about the impact of diet on our health, we have to be methodical, we have to be consistent, and we have to track the data to decide, did a dietary change actually be of benefit to someone?
Yeah. Anything else to add, Dr. Thrower?
Yeah, I think Dr. Greenberg hit on a great point, and that's the idea of being methodical about it. Ideally, you'd like to, if someone's going to kind of go down a dietary pathway or changing a medication, you'd like to change one thing at a time if possible. It's not always reasonable. You know, we may be changing medications while the person's changing their diet, but as much as you can, really having the person try to change one variable at a time to see what works and what doesn't work, and give it a you know, an adequate amount of time before we make a decision.
So we're going to shift gears a little bit here from the diet and microbiome. There are a number of questions that came in about stem cells. What we know, what we don't know, is there a role for stem cells in as a regenerative or restorative therapy in these diseases? Could you speak to what has been done, what is currently being done in types of stem cell work with these disorders, and what the future may hold? Dr. Greenberg, can you start with your thoughts?
Yeah, so this is a, if I'm very transparent, a particularly frustrating area, I think, within our field, because like a lot of things, we run up against two issues. One is the term stem cell gets used very differently by lots of people, and it makes it, we all have to make sure we're talking about the same thing at the same time in any conversation. And this set, and there are lots of types of stem cells that could be used therapeutically. Secondly, while there is, I believe, a huge potential for cell-based therapy to help our patients either repair from damage that's been done or prevent future damage for patients with recurring disease. The works is not over yet, but in the meantime, fee-for-service clinics all around the world, including the United States, have opened up with extremely little data and haphazard approaches to safety monitoring around the world, but based on a natural desire for people to seek any possible treatment, a lot of patients are subjecting themselves to risky, unproven procedures. There are multiple documented cases of patients coming back from overseas, whether it be Central America, South America, Mexico, China, Russia, Europe, you name it, after having quote unquote stem cell therapies, who have either died or developed tumors. And these are documented cases, but they don't get tracked or followed in a systematic way from the clinics who are charging $10, $20, $30, $40, $50,000 per treatment. You could never get away with that in the United States, where there's a safety net to make sure that people are who are in a vulnerable situation, who are looking for help, don't get exposed to risky, expensive therapies that haven't been proven. Now, that said, I think we're going to get there. I think we are going to get to a place where cell-based therapy is helpful for our patients. And it's going to be a question of which cells. So we get asked all the time about the various sources of cells. So you can take a person's own adult cells and re-engineer a stem cell, so-called induced pluripotent stem cells. You can take cell lines that were derived from previous fetal tissue to create stem cells, which is much has a different approach. There are stem cells that get obtained from cord blood samples at the time of birth. And then you'll hear about people using the mesenchymal stem cells that come from supposedly from fat tissue or other tissues in the body. And it's important to know that these different cell types are not comparable, but either in efficacy potential, in what it can do for the human body, or in risk. And so, for example, when using fetal-based stem cells, the key is the control and what they're turning into. You don't want these cells, if we put these into a spinal cord, you don't want them to grow a tooth or a heart muscle in your spinal cord. You want to make sure we control them to grow into certain cells. If we take a person's own cell and edit the genes and turn it back into a stem cell, we have concerns about tumors later in life. For mesenchymal stem cells, there are significant concerns about immune reactions to these cells. And the last thing one of my transverse myelitis patients needs is new inflammation in their spinal cord because of a stem cell therapy. And so these all have unique issues to them that need to be systematically studied so we know what the risks are and can have full disclosure, what the potential benefits are, and what will be the right match in terms of which patient will benefit the most. Those studies are moving forward. We're getting there. But in the meantime, I worry about a lot of folks who are appropriately invested and seeking any answer, any possible help. I worry about the vulnerability of people getting involved in unproven, risky, and extremely expensive procedures.
Dr. Thoreau, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think Dr. Greenberg hit it right on the head that it's an area of a lot of hope and a lot of potential, but we're not quite there yet. And because we're not quite there yet, people with different health conditions can be easy targets for, you know, being taken advantage of. We, you know, when you think about mesenchymal stem cells, like Dr. Greenberg says, we don't know is it best that they come from fat? Is it best that they come from bone marrow? Do they go into the bloodstream? Do they go into the spinal fluid? Do they get surgically transplanted into the cord itself? These are things that are all still being actively looked at, and hopefully we'll have answers soon. In the meantime, you know, to think that someone's going to go down to a for-profit clinic and spend their hard-earned money for and have cells of unknown origin put in is just a little frightening. We've had individuals do it. We've been fortunate in that we've not seen anything catastrophic happen, but I haven't seen anything good happen either. I guess it's catastrophic that the person's out tens of thousands of dollars. One of the stem cell therapies that comes up sometimes as well is the whole idea of hematopoietic stem cell or autologous stem cell transplants. And this is a little outside of what people usually think of in terms of a reparative or regenerative stem cell. This is more like a bone marrow transplant. And so the idea is that for a person with an autoimmune condition, if the immune system is picking on something that it shouldn't be picking on, can we just clean the hard drive, give you a new immune system using your own immature cells from your bone marrow and start all over again? And there's a lot of appeal to the theory of it, where the challenge has been is selecting the right individual and maintaining safety. At least in the multiple sclerosis world, the safety appears to be getting better. We're still, you know, trying to look at who is the best individual that might benefit from that, and how does the safety and efficacy of that procedure compare to some of the more traditional medications that we have. Just like in the regenerative stem cell world, you know, where there are for-profit clinics that have popped up, there are for-profit clinics that have popped up in the autologous stem cell transplant world, primarily Mexico and Russia. And we've had individuals go to both places. They are doing legitimate procedures. The problem that we run into there is even if their technique and their procedure is reasonable, the follow-up is non-existent. So you've just had a major, you know, procedure where your bone marrow was wiped out, you're regenerating a new immune system, and then you're put on a plane to go home, frequently with your home doctors being completely outside the loop of what you've just had done, and probably not able to offer the best continuity of care because they weren't involved in the initial procedure. So I'd say, like Dr. Greenberg said, great hope, great potential, but just, you know, people just need to do their due diligence and really look into the risks and benefits of any of these procedures.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most important point here for, you know, this today with any patient. There's really a lot more unknowns than knowns when it comes to the potential for stem cell therapies, and that it comes down to an individual choice and based on someone's personal research and talking to their teams and figuring out if that's right for them. I wanted to move on to a different, what I think is an important question that I think comes up from time to time, specifically in the neuromyelitis optica world, is the potential for being off any kind of traditional therapy and going strictly with something like diet or other kind of supplemental medications or things like that for disease modification. Dr. Greenberg, do you have any thoughts or how you counsel patients who are thinking about getting off treatment entirely?
Yeah, and I think this is an issue that comes up not infrequently. We would all, our goal, and I mean not just our patients and families, but the entire healthcare team, is to help promote health, prevent disability in the safest, most efficacious, reliable way with the least amount of intervention or cost as possible. That is our absolute stated goal. And the challenge is the lack of data we have, the lack of understanding we have on crafting personalized medicine plans where I can tell someone their month-to-month relative risk or need for different interventions. And so we take a blunt force approach to this, a population approach to this, saying where we have data that has been beneficial in 100, 200, 300, 1,000 patients, we let that data guide us. And when talking with patients about being on or off a therapy, Dr. Thrower's comment at the beginning of the call is the right one, and that is, instead of the term alternative, I think the term complementary is more appropriate, because I'm a big believer in an all of the above strategy, as long as the safety and interaction data is known between those interventions. And so if somebody's interested in using diet, exercise, supplements as a way to manage a condition, in general, I don't object at all, but I look at it as additional intervention on top of some of the prescribed medicines where we actually have data to say they work. And the analogy I use is to blackjack in Las Vegas. If we advertised today that there was a blackjack table at a casino in Las Vegas that was paying off four times out of every five hands, every five hands you were going to get a blackjack four times, or even three times out of five hands, we would all be in Las Vegas right now at that blackjack table, because the statistics are telling us it's in our best, that we're going to make money. We're going to win. Are we going to win every time? No, we're going to lose a couple of hands, but over and over again, we're going to win. And the data for the medications we use in neuromyelitis optica, whether it's things like rituximab or mycophenolate or any of the other interventions we use, are in that range where the payoff is way more common than the losses. And so would I add to the therapies? In general, yes. Now, there are exceptions to this, where there are individual patients who can't be on one of the traditional therapies of prevention, and it absolutely comes up. But assuming there aren't medical reasons to avoid those therapies, in general, I like to combine versus pick or choose.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Thurr, do you have a specific way that you counsel your patients?
Yeah, I'm going to steal Dr. Greenberg's blackjack analogy. I like that. The other things that I usually put on the table for people to think about is, and to help educate me, is if they're thinking about going off of a traditional therapy, that why? Is it fear of side effects? Is there something that we can do to make that more palatable? Is it, you know, are they missing work because they have to come in for a rituximab infusion? Just to try to get a sense of, is there something that's blocking them being successful with the drug that we can fix on our end? Is there a financial concern that's there? And then also make sure that we've had a discussion about what things might look like without treatment and what the risk is, specifically with neuromyelitis optica. If we go off of treatment and the person has a relapse, what's the likelihood that they're going to keep a new level of disability, and make sure that you know, we've had an honest discussion with that individual. We tell our healthcare team here that I think we should be guidance counselors. I want the person with NMO or transverse myelitis or MS to know what we know, and to help partner in making that decision and really put all the cards on the table. We're not smart enough yet in neurology to have biomarkers or some sort of predictive test to say Mr. Smith can go off of treatment safely, whereas Mrs. Jones can't. We're not there yet. You know, maybe we'll be someday, and we can make a smart, perfect 2020 crystal vision prediction ahead of time. But right now, it's an educated guess, and sometimes the results of guessing wrong, if the person has breakthrough disease, can be significant.
Yeah, I think that's all very important. I want to move in. There are a number of questions that came in that fit more in the symptomatic management category. A number of questions that came in specifically on alternative ways to manage neuropathic pain, spasticity, those kind of interrelated issues. And most of the questions that came in really focused around different techniques or different aspects of manipulating the musculoskeletal system, things like massage, the Bowen technique was asked in the question, even things like acupuncture. Are these whether it be these specific kind of interventions or just this concept of musculoskeletal therapies helping with pain and spasticity. Is that something that you all think about when you have patients with pain as a non-pharmaceutical way to treat it? I'll start with you, Dr. Thoreau. Do you have any thoughts?
Sure. So obviously, you know, spasticity, spasms, and then what we call central neuropathic pain or kind of burning, hypersensitivity, those sorts of things are pretty common with these inflammatory demyelinating conditions. And the first thing we like to do before we automatically reach for the prescription pad is talk about what non-pharmacologic interventions. And so any of the things that you mentioned, I think are fair game. So the usual where I start at it with when it comes to spasticity is what we'll call removing noxious stimuli. So if a person is, let's say, in a power chair or manual chair and it's not appropriately fitted to them, just that positioning alone in some people can result in increased pain, whether it's from neuropathic pain or spasticity. Making sure that we're managing bladder symptoms. If the person has a lot of overactive bladder symptoms or they're prone to urinary tract infections, that can worsen pain. If the person has chronic constipation, that's going to be a factor in their spasticity. Then we kind of go the next step up and look at rehabilitation strategies, getting the person in with a physical therapist for spasticity. There's data out there for acupuncture and acupressure for spasticity. I think that those are certainly reasonable options for someone to pursue. I've not had experience directly with the Bowen technique, you know, looking at what it does in terms of specific, you know, maneuvers. I don't think it would be unreasonable to try out. I've just not had experience with our patients in doing that. Once you've covered those bases, then we move into the realm of the pharmacologic, and certainly, you know, we have numerous medications. I tell our patients, the good news is almost any symptom you think of, I have a medication I can throw back at it. The bad news is almost any symptom you can think of, I have a medication I can throw back at it. And I think we have to be mindful that we're not, you know, sending the patient down a path of having, you know, multiple medications. There are alternatives out there in regards to things like cannabinoids. It's a question we get all the time. Right now in the United States, 43 states have some sort of law on the books regarding quote-unquote medical marijuana or medical cannabis. Here in Georgia, we have a CBD registry so that we can put individuals with certain health conditions into this registry, and they can legally possess CBD oil with up to 5% THC. Our challenge here in Georgia has been early on, we were really at a loss for where to send individuals to get the product, but we do have some great solutions now for patients having access, you know, to that. So that's, you know, we get a lot of questions on that. I would say anecdotally, we have had patients do very well with spasticity, spasms, and central neuropathic pain with cannabinoid products.
Dr. Greenberg, do you have anything to add?
I think Ben is right. Dr. Thoreau is right in terms of, I think there's a lot of options here. We do regular referrals for acupuncture. There are controlled trials where with neuropathic pain, there are responders to acupuncture, and the safety record of it is extensive. And that's one that is a regular referral for us to see if somebody will be a responder, non-responder. The physical manipulation programs, and there's a variety of them, get tougher for me. So the what you referred to, the Bowen technique, has a long history, and it's got a lot of different names. Bowen therapy, Bowen technique, some people call it fascial kinetics. Some people, there's an acronym NST that gets used. And this has been largely discounted as being beneficial in the setting of a neurologic injury. But the person who developed it was an interesting story. He was a non-clinician, non-therapist, non-anything healthcare related, and indicated that The approach was a gift from God that he had been trained as a holistic healer, and started doing back in the 70s, this treatment of moving people into specific positions in different ways. And then it got picked up by a variety of practitioners, but it's gone through reviews in different places around the world, and there isn't the data. I think when we start putting titles to certain things like the Bowen technique, what we're really talking about for some folks is stretching, and stretching's great. and having a trainer or a physical therapist work with somebody based on their specific neurologic function to design a stretching routine to help with spasticity or neuropathic pain or flexibility, that stretching is wonderful. I'm not sure we have to sometimes dress it up into a different name in order to create some sort of program, which usually requires a fee for service. I try to be very sensitive as much as possible to all of my patients' healthcare dollars, because things are very expensive and they add up very quickly and people have to make choices. And so there are some places where would I consider something like the Bowen technique dangerous? No. Would I rather have an insurance company cover working with a physical therapist to come up with an at-home stretching routine? Yes. And so for manual manipulation, massage, which I think are great but unproven, there's not a safety concern. The one out of those with data would be the acupuncture.
Yeah. That's good to know. I think that's a lot of that information is not necessarily, succinctly stated out there. And so it's always good to have that kind of rounded out. As we're getting to the end of the hour, there's really one more question I wanted to bring up that I thought was important in the symptom management category. And it's really for the lingering effects after something like an ADEM event, that where there's memory issues or inhibitory control problems and different other neuropsychological effects, is something like neurofeedback an effective treatment? And could you maybe, starting with you, Dr. Thrower, explain what neurofeedback is, and do you think that that is something that is really effective, could be effective for a kind of a cognitive symptom?
Yeah, so absolutely. So I think the first part of that is to really document what's going on. And so typically we would have someone see a neuropsychologist and get cognitive testing done so that we really have a sense of where the strong areas and maybe not as strong areas are, so that we can develop a plan. It would be our speech pathologist, speech therapist, who would actually work on cognitive rehabilitation along with the neuropsychologist in other facilities that they might have occupational therapy contributing to some of those areas. Usually the cognitive deficits, they may not exist in isolation. So we also take a look at fatigue. If the person is having quite a bit of fatigue, that's going to sometimes magnify the cognitive deficits. And then also look at mood. If you just look at an individual who has depression, the depressed individual will frequently say that their memory is not good. What they're really saying is that their ability to store new information is not good, because their attention and concentration are down. So it feels like their memory is not great. Friends, family members will say, they're not paying attention to me. We just had this conversation and they don't remember any of it. It was because they didn't store that information to pull it out. So documenting where the problem is at is the first step. And then trying to work on some tools. Some cognitive issues are amenable to treatment, and through things like neurofeedback, making the person aware of their environment or being mindful of their environment so that they can self-regulate. Other times it's tougher. I mean, we have individuals who become somewhat disinhibited. So normally, if they're at a family gathering, they might say, well, gosh, Aunt Bessie's really put on a lot of weight. And normally they would think that. And now they say, Aunt Bessie, you're really fat now. And then they feel horrible about it later. That sort of disinhibition can be tough. sometimes to work with. But again, I think it goes back to what we said earlier, that it's part of this comprehensive team approach, getting a lot of you know, eyes and ears to sort out the problem and throw in as many resources as we can at it.
Yeah. Dr. Greenberg, do you have anything to add regarding cognitive symptoms and alternative therapies or neurofeedback?
Well, I agree with Dr. Thrower. I will zero in on the specifically the neurofeedback side of the question, because I want to be very careful to make sure to distinguish two things for our listeners, biofeedback versus neurofeedback. And biofeedback is a exploding field with data behind the idea of integrating different events so people can modulate their awareness and mindfulness, as Dr. Thrower was mentioning. Sometimes when people use the term neurofeedback, often they are specifically referring to a fee-for-service therapy where an EEG is obtained on a patient and you are, quote, taught to control your brain waves by looking at a screen of your EEG. And this has been going on for literally decades. People have looked at this. Unfortunately, the logic behind neurofeedback with an EEG is quite flawed. Not only is the data for it not lacking, there's some data to say that it is no better and, in fact, worse than placebo interventions on getting people to be mindful. And this is an example of it's perfectly safe to do. So I cannot think of any medical, physical harm that would come from doing neurofeedback, but I worry about three other harms. Number one, the financial. Number two, I worry about people going down, investing the time and effort, who are clearly committed to trying to improve quality of life, and using time and effort on things that have so little data, when that time and effort could be spent with individuals or therapies that actually have a track record. And the third is the notion of feeding an industry that is based on fear and based on vulnerability. And so for neurofeedback in particular, I tend to say to my patients, listen, I am with you. The cognitive symptoms are real. We need to help. We need to work. But let's get plugged in with a variety of programs. There are lots of things we can do for mindfulness without paying to hook you up to an EEG machine. And so I tend not to endorse neurofeedback, but definitely understand that interventions for the cognitive issues have to be pursued.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point to keep in mind. Again, it's kind of similar to the stem cell conversation, is kind of being a thoughtful consumer, for lack of a better term, and looking into things and conferring with people, with your care team, about what these new, potentially unproven therapies or interventions may be. So as we're getting to the last few minutes of the hour, I wanted to turn it back over to Dr. Greenberg and Dr. Thrower to give some final thoughts, round out the conversation that we've had for the community that's listening. Dr. Thrower, do you have any final thoughts?
Again, just thank you to you, Sam, and to Dr. Greenberg for allowing me to join in today. I appreciate everything that the TMA does. Again, I think just in wrapping up, I would just encourage people to, when you think about, you know, you're managing your health, think of it as using a comprehensive team, and rather than alternative, think of it as something that is complementary. The other term that is bantered about up there that I think is important is integrative care. So making sure that not only you have a comprehensive team, so you've got all these pieces of the puzzle, but that the pieces of the puzzle are talking to each other so that you get a coordinated effort in your healthcare.
And Dr. Greenberg?
Yeah, I agree, and want to thank you, Sam, Dr. Thrower, and the TMA for hosting this. I agree. The key things are communication, Always make sure that your healthcare team know what you are trying, because sometimes the risky therapies or therapies that may interact with something being prescribed need to be recognized. A lot of patients and families feel uncomfortable raising questions about alternative therapies with their physicians. And frankly, a lot of physicians, myself included, don't have a huge background or formal training in the various alternative therapies. That said, always engage with your healthcare team to let them know what you're considering and what you're doing so that we can be an effective partner in your health.
Okay. Thank you both once again, Dr. Thrower and Dr. Greenberg, for your time and your expertise on these issues and your ability to be here, interests in the community. And thank you everyone who submitted questions. I apologize again for not getting to all of them. There are some great questions. Thank you for everyone who's listening, and hope everyone has a great week and look forward to the next podcast next month. Thanks all.
Thank you.
Thank you.